This episode of Behind the Video is brought to you by the Independent Media Network. The Independent Media Network helps journalists and content creators create their own jobs by building sustainable online businesses. If you're an unemployed or underemployed journalist or content creator, visit imnct.com for more information. Hey everybody, it is Lon Seiben. We are back for Behind the Video. This is our 90th episode. It's like a weekly therapy session for Tim Street, my co-host. Hey Tim, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am great. We have a guest on the show today.
Michael Weinberg. How are you?
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Calling
Michael,
us.
What do you do in Washington, D.C.?
I work for an organization called Public Knowledge, and we advocate on behalf of the public and consumers on technology policy issues, a lot of internet-y type stuff. So we do internet advocacy for you.
Well, thank you on behalf of us. you're busy lately. There's a lot going on, right?
Yeah.
So we got this net neutrality thing going on. Like, what's top of mind right now at Public Knowledge?
Yeah, it sort of seems like it all comes at once. I think that there's a combination of net neutrality and the Comcast Time Warner Cable merger, and then the sort of the third part of that are these peering agreements. The deal that Netflix and Comcast cut is kind of spilling over to a lot of other things. So we do a lot of kind of copyright stuff, which is the other half of the house. But on the internet side, man, it seems like that when it rains, it pours.
It seems like that. And you know, let's talk just quickly about net neutrality, especially as it relates to independent creators. So right now, a bulk of my independent content creation ends up on YouTube.
That's because
I put it there. And you know, I'm kind of largely tied to Google's fortunes now, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it. But you know what? For someone who's out there trying to produce their own content and wants to compete with larger media organizations and whatnot, and maybe they want to go out on their own, I mean, is there an argument to be made that having some government-regulated neutrality is beneficial to consumers in the long run? Because some say that it opens the door to more regulation that might create problems that people aren't anticipating. So where's the happy medium in your mind or your organization's mind on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to put all of this in perspective, right? So the first part of it is one of the great things about the internet historically is that everything is treated equal. So whether or not you're a startup or an established player, if you put stuff up on the internet and it's good, you can compete because ISPs, internet service providers, basically have to deliver things totally equally. And you know, it's easy to forget, but that's not the way that things have to be. You know, the universe is not aligned that way. A lot of that actually does flow from some very basic rules of the road that the government put down and maintained over time. And so when you think about, okay, well, what's the role for government as sort of a cop on the beat of these things? Hopefully it's a very light touch where they say, look, you can do whatever you want on the internet. But for those companies who are involved with connecting people to the internet, they just have to treat everything the same. They can't really look at what's going on. They say, look, a bit is a bit is a bit. We move it around, and that's all we do. And because there's that kind of basic level playing field, all sorts of things can confidently be built upon that, and you get all the crazy things, all the good things, all the not so good things that you see on the internet beyond that.
So is it good then to say, to have the government say, and I'm of two minds in this right now,
because
I think it's hard to balance some things in my head with it right now. Is it a good thing for the government to say all bits need to be created equal, and can that be done without creating more hurdles for the industry in the process, in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer to that is yes. I think there is a government role it's an oversight role. You know, sometimes we have a new chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, and one of the things that he has said is, you know, if you have a world where, if we're looking at a market where there's a lot of competition, maybe you need less government regulation. If you're looking at a world where there isn't a lot of competition, then you need more government regulation to counterbalance that, because you don't have those sort of business forces. And I think in a lot of these markets that we're talking about, there is not a lot of competition for real, true, high-speed internet. And so you don't have those market forces creating checks on behavior. And so in that situation, you need something, you need some force that steps in and says, no, you cannot leverage the fact that you have a monopoly over all these people, if you're an ISP, to control it. And so I think it's really important. Sometimes people hear about net neutrality and they say, oh, well, this is going to be government kind of telling people what they can do online or regulating what's happening on the internet. And conceptually, it's really important to separate out internet access, kind of connecting to the network, and what happens on that network. I think most people, certainly me, public knowledge, we don't think there's a government role, except for in some limited situations, for talking about what happens on the network, what people are actually doing. All we care about is that access to the network is equal and balanced for people.
How did public knowledge start?
We actually started, we're about 12 years old, and we really started in the late 90s when the internet was just starting to develop.
It's a good time to start.
There was a series of discussions around copyright, where people were trying to figure out how copyright would work online, and it resulted in this law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA. And this is the law that's used to take down infringing copyright stuff from the internet and all sorts of...
Wasn't that a rap group run DMCA?
It could very well be. And you know, basically that law ended up being a balance between the people who were in the room negotiating it, which was some of the larger content holders and a few of the early tech companies, you know, like AOL and Prodigy and things like that. And there really wasn't anyone representing kind of the general public and consumers and the future users of what would be this explosion of the internet. And so public knowledge was created so in the future, as there are these conversations about regulations and laws that touch on the internet, to make sure that there's someone at the table who says, look, yeah, we are not a huge company, but we are all the people who are using this technology. And so we are trying to balance all these different needs, make sure that you take that into account. And so we started from there, and so we do still do a lot of copyright work, but obviously if you're paying attention to what's happening on the internet, you also need to understand all the telecommunication stuff from a legal standpoint. And so we have long been very involved with all these open internet issues that tend to surface and kind of cycle around the FCC.
How do we get people... Sorry, go ahead, Tim.
So let me play devil's advocate here for a second. Let's say that I'm some big ISP, and I've spent all this money building out all this pipe, and I've done it not out of the goodness of my heart, but because I'm a business, I want to make money, and now you're telling me that I'm not allowed to do what I want to do with the thing that I spent money building out. I mean, come on, this is America. Isn't it free? Shouldn't I be allowed to do what I want to do with the thing that I built?
Yeah, I think in general the answer to that question is yeah. If you built it, you should be able to do this. There are a couple things that make telecommunications networks special and unique. I mean, one of them is that they really are a conduit for speech, and so we do have a public interest in making sure that that conduit is open because so many other things flow from that. And the other thing is that you influence so many things. I mean, it's a lot like thinking about it like roads or other people. We can debate about whether internet is a utility, but making sure that there are some simple rules of the road on how the internet works. There's a larger public interest beyond like if you opened an amusement park or something like that, where we'd say, you know, go and do whatever you want. When you have critical communications infrastructure, it's worth having someone there who represents the public, who represents the government, saying, well, we want to make sure that this works. And the other thing is that no one is saying that these networks don't have a right to make money and make lots of money, but they need access to all sorts of public things to make their networks work. They need, some of them need spectrum, some of them need rights of way to be able to run cables on public streets and thoroughfares, and so in exchange for that, we need to make sure that those are being done for the public interest as well as being able to make a return on those investments for the companies.
One of the things that I saw here in my state, and this happened before internet really became a primary activity of a lot of service providers, was that we had, you know, essentially a regulated cable monopoly in Connecticut, and we had a number of cable companies. We have fewer now, but still have more than one. in different parts of the state. When the phone company, AT&T, started offering television services, those regulated franchise agreements were dissolved, and the cable companies could essentially do whatever it is that they wanted to do. Do you see that becoming a hindrance to creating more neutrality on the local level? Because it seems like these monopolies, if you look at the company nationally, isn't necessarily as big of a monopoly as it might be locally to me, where I only have one choice.
I mean, thinking about these things, it's really important to define the market, because if you look at the country as a whole, there are at least a handful of different, you know, cable companies, or there are a handful of different ISPs out there. But at in any one place, for most people, they're very few. And depending on how you define kind of real broadband, for a lot of people, there's one. There's the cable company. And well, go ahead.
What as an independent content creator, why do I care? How does this affect me? I mean, this all sounds like gobbledygook, political banter.
So you got the two policy wonks on here, Tim. That's what happens.
Yeah, I mean, why do you care, right? Because one of the reasons that you are able to be an independent content creator for a lot of those creators is because you can distribute your stuff on the internet. You know, the reason that you're going to the internet and you're not going to cable or other traditional medium is because there was no barrier to entry. There's a very low barrier to entry. You're basically free to do whatever you want on it, because the company that is sort of involved in that core distribution is basically stepping back. And so one of the concerns that we have, and one of the things that net neutrality is designed to protect, is to make sure that there's still that wide open playing field. So if you're an independent producer and you say, okay, I want to make this show and I want to distribute it, all you have to do is you have to make the show and you have to distribute it. The thing that you don't have to do is fly around the country playing golf with, you know, vice president of business development for all the different ISPs and hope that you can cut a special distribution deal for each ISP in the country. Because, you know, there are plenty of ways you can broadcast content where you have to do that, and that, you know, those are fine. But one of the things that makes the internet great is you traditionally haven't had to do that.
Right. And let me ask you about members of Congress, because I've interviewed members of Congress before. I know a few. It seems to be that most members of Congress aren't very technically proficient, and they are aware that their colleagues aren't either. I had an interview with Congressman Himes from Connecticut about the NSA stuff. And he was certainly more versed on it and more sophisticated than a lot of his colleagues are. How do you bridge that gap? How do you get, because, you know, it seems like people generally, just consumers, don't care. They should care, but they don't. So we're kind of reliant upon members of Congress, and you have some competition in, at least in the sense of trying to get your point across, because you have more and better funded lobbyists on opposing views to your own. How do you navigate this?
Yeah, I mean, those are two issues. One is the sort of technical awareness of members of Congress. And there are some members of Congress who have a very good understanding of how these things work. There are others who almost seem to revel in the fact that they don't understand, both that they don't understand how it works, but they're really excited about regulating it and really getting involved,
right,
which is always interesting. I think, you know, the key is to find, when you're talking to those legislators, first of all, to find a way to translate it for them that it makes sense. But yeah, you're right. There is this other side of it, which is, it's not just us going up there and saying net neutrality is really important. There are plenty of well-funded companies who are going up and saying, well, this net neutrality thing is really getting in the way of us doing X, Y, or Z. And we are outgunned. I mean, I was in a meeting on Friday with most of our Washington public interest allies on this. And, you know, we all fit in one room,
right.
And we have, you know, we have a handful of people who are going up there, and you're talking about companies, you know, Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, who often have, who can, you know, have ratios of lobbyists to members of Congress in the kind of one to, sometimes it's one to one, you know, one to six, one to ten. They can just blanket those members. But, you know, people, the thing that even turns cynics around sometimes is, while it is totally true that in a vacuum, when you're talking to members of Congress, if the only people that care are you know, one or two public interest voices and the companies, it can be hard. The good news is a lot of people do care about net neutrality, and so they hear from their constituents about this, and that is an incredibly powerful thing. I mean, you know, if you're outside of Washington, you probably hear every once in a while all sorts of people saying, call your member of Congress, call your member of Congress. And you say, oh, well, you know, what's a phone call from me going to be? That is a thing that they track. They track really closely. And so we walk in and we make the best case that we can. And I think that, you know, the other advantage is that we are right. So that always helps in an argument. But when we walk in with the right argument and they know they're hearing from their constituents about it, that really does tend to focus the mind a little bit.
You know, the SOPA-PIPA debate certainly was a great example of that. You know, I had talked to some members who said that they had as much or more constituent outreach on that issue than they did for even the healthcare bill, which was pretty shocking to hear. But, you know, do you risk kind of, you know, firing all your guns at one of these issues and then losing that momentum for others?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is about. I mean, SOPA and PIPA was great. We were very involved in that. But there is this threat of saying, well, if you don't reach the level of SOPA and PIPA, then maybe this isn't for real. I mean, we do some work on privacy. We have allies who do a lot of work on privacy. And a couple of weeks ago, they hammered the Hill. They had, you know, millions of people calling Capitol Hill about NSA spying stuff. And some members said, wow, this is really great. But a lot of the coverage of it was, oh, well, you know, if Google didn't black out, if Wikipedia didn't black out, then the internet really isn't mad. So you do need to make sure that you focus what you're doing. And it's true. I mean, you know, I go to work every day focusing on things like net neutrality. I recognize that most people go to work every day focusing on creating independent content, you know, working at a bank, doing whatever they're doing. And so they're only gonna make that phone call a couple of times, and so you need to be really kind of conscientious about when you tell people and when you ask people to do that, because it is a tool that you can take off the wall, but not every day.
Right. So you got to be really careful how you do that. So
yeah.
So Michael,
is there a time that it would be best? I mean, is there a point where things come to a head where we should activate the troops?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we're thinking about right now, especially around net neutrality. I mean, so net neutrality is in this weird place where in 2010, the FCC passed these rules about net neutrality, and they were almost immediately challenged by Verizon in court. At the end of last year, the court essentially threw all those rules out. And so the FCC is now saying, okay, well, we know net neutrality is important, and we're going to say net neutrality is important over and over, but now we need to figure out how we do net neutrality in light of this decision. And so they're beginning this process. And the question is, when is the most effective time for them to hear from thousands, tens of thousands, millions of people? My guess, I wish I had a specific time to tell you right now. I think the honest answer is that there's going to be a time in the spring, probably May, maybe even summer, May or June, where the FCC basically says, here's what we're thinking about net neutrality. Public, weigh in, comment on this. And that's going to be the time where we say, okay, we now have a sense of what the FCC is thinking, and we need to make sure that they understand how important this is and what's going on. And so while there are always good times to call your member of Congress about it, I think the honest answer is you're going to start hearing from groups like mine May, June, when we have this concrete thing out of the FCC and say, okay, this is the time to weigh in on this. This is the time to act.
And that seems to be right around the same time as VidCon. Are you going to be at VidCon this year?
I have sent emails and proposed conversations there. We haven't locked anything down yet, but I think, I mean, you know, Tim, we did something last year and we did something the year before. You know, VidCon, net neutrality is an important issue for a lot of different reasons and a lot of different constituencies, but for video creators, it's like blaringly obvious why it is so important, both because video just requires a lot of data. I mean, this is something that we've seen in the Netflix context, and so video is much more sensitive to restrictions on the network than, say, you know, writing is or even photography. But also, so many of these ISPs are also cable companies, and so they have a direct financial reason to undermine independent online video, because every successful independent online video show or program or channel makes it more likely that someone's going to get rid of cable. And so it's really important, especially for the online video community, to really be focused on this. And, you know, you can not care for any ideological reason. You should just care from a business reason. Right. Because it's, you know, it, you're really vulnerable if an ISP that's also a cable company decides, oh, well, we're just not going to do this.
Right. It's like YouTube is just not going to be available on Comcast.
Yeah,
right. Or they could make it just so unusable that you're not going to even want to look at it.
Or they could say, "Hey, YouTube, pay us money, and we'll make sure your videos perform well."
Right, which they could do too.
Yeah.
Sorry, Maker.
Right. Well, and that's
your videos are going to be really slow.
Right.
That's the thing, right? So it happened. It can happen kind of in two layers. First of all, they can make YouTube pay them a lot of money, and so that's money that comes out of somewhere else. So maybe they. You know, they change their model a little bit, which creates a huge problem. But it also means that we say, maybe you say to yourself, okay, well, whatever, you know, they're going to make YouTube pay, and YouTube will pay because Google has a lot of money and they'll do it. But what that does is that really, you know, locks you further into YouTube. I mean, I know YouTube is a great platform. People really like it. But if YouTube is paying ISPs a lot of money to be able to work, that means that other video distribution platforms probably aren't going to perform as well, aren't going to be able to afford to do that. And so if you're a creator and you say, yeah, I love YouTube, I love it as its distribution platform, but maybe I don't want to be totally locked into it forever, this is something that could create a situation where YouTube would have even more advantages over any competitors. And you just say, okay, well, it's whatever YouTube decides, and if you know, whenever they decide to change something, I have no option to go anywhere else.
Now, is there a way that this could swing the other way to where the government decides to tax ISPs or any video being served to the internet? You have to pay a government tax, and then that money goes back to the ISP to subsidize their support. So be careful what you wish for, kind of thing. Could it go in a wrong direction for us?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how that would work, right? Because ISPs are in a position to collect money from people directly.
Right. So if they had to, like, okay, well, you're serving videos, so now you have to pay the video tax.
Right.
So they take that money, they give it to the government, and then the government subsidizes that by giving it back to the ISP.
Right. So I mean, why not just have the ISP just raise prices directly for people for video?
Because it would shut us all up about internet neutrality.
You know, it's funny, yeah. In where I live, what happened you know, with Comcast is the state requires the cable provider to make a public access station available to the community. Probably not as relevant now as it used to be, given that everyone can go on YouTube now. But back when they, you know, created this thing, part of the deal was you're going to be granted this monopoly on the pole. You know, telephone pole. So therefore, you're going to create a television studio for the community, and you know, we've been beating them up over the years because they've been, you know, playing games around what their obligations are with it. And one year they decided just to add it as a line item on the bill that, you know, you're paying 85 cents a month to support the cable access channel. You know,
right.
And that
call
was
your
kind
member of Congress.
Yeah, right. If you have a problem with it, call your legislator. And you know, and that was kind of where I could see to Tim's point, I could see them doing that. You know, like the net neutrality fee or something that. You know, they claim is what is costing them to have this equal thing, and you know, when people call to complain, they say, oh, well, you know, call your congressman who made this happen, you know, requirement or whatever. But it's anything's possible.
Right. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And, you know, they can play all sorts of games with how the pricing is. I think, you know, but that highlights another interesting point about the difference between the internet and something like cable. Right. On cable, you had to get into a situation where you needed a specific regulation to say you need to dedicate some of these scarce cable channels to the public, and people are going to use it however they want, or, you know, they'll apply and there's a process. On the internet, you don't need to do that because it's kind of like the entire internet is open the way that one public access channel was.
Right.
And traditionally you haven't needed to have those fights. I mean, like you said, you know, there's the rule about having public access channels, but then you're constantly fighting about, oh, but what are you going to do with that channel, and how are you going to support it, and you know, how are you going to maintain it? But with the internet, you just say, look, you just keep it open. We're not going to rely on you for very much. You just have to stay out of the way and let people do whatever they want to do.
Right. So have it be a free and open highway is where
right.
It'll go. So Tim took the free and open highway to South by Southwest, or maybe the airway. And Michael, if you don't mind sticking around, we're going to talk a little about the news, and you know, feel free to pipe in on anything that comes up. But Tim, you spent the week at South by Southwest. Was there anything of interest there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, other than the networking and the parties and the great films and all the great sessions, there were things that just went on that you had to pay attention to find. But they were pretty easy to find. One of the biggest things, one of the highlights, was the Samsung Blogger Lounge that was hosted by Shira Lazar and What's Trending. And Shira was doing her live show there and had lots of guests coming in, anybody from Rosario Dawson to, I'm trying to think who else, Wayne Brady came in. I mean, lots of different celebrities would come in and talk about what they're working on. And so really fun place to hang out, free food, free drinks, and place to sit down with free Wi-Fi. It was almost like, why do you want to go anyplace else? Because all of South by Southwest was coming there to the Samsung Blogger Lounge. And
can you walk in with your iPhone into the Samsung Blogger Lounge, or is that?
Yes, you can. They're very kind about
that.
You
pay a licensing fee or something when you.
No chargers, right? Yes.
Plenty of chargers there, by the way. It was a great place to charge your phone, but great for meetings, really good. And they weren't the only ones. In the convention center, Brian Solis a couple other folks have a blogger lounge there. I guess this year it was called the Social Media Lounge, sponsored by PayPal, and they had kind of the same thing. They had, you know, live stage performances and people coming in being interviewed and free food, free drink, and those weren't the only ones. I mean, there were lots of different lounges around town. Indiegogo had one. So basically, once you get off the plane, there's a $1.50 bus that you can take from the airport that'll get you to downtown Austin. And if you know what you're doing, you're not going to have to spend any money after that.
Everything's free, huh?
Until it comes time to get back on a bus to go to the airport.
Wow. This is my kind of place. How come I didn't go?
Yeah, exactly.
Like Vegas isn't like that.
But just amazing. I mean, for me, some of the highlights, every year I go to see a Working with Actors workshop that Jeffrey Tambor puts on, and it's just amazing. It's just so much fun. And he basically does the same routine every year, but he does it with two different actors. He'll pick a man and a woman, somebody usually in their 20s or early 30s, and he'll have them act out a scene together, and he'll give them instructions along the way, and he'll interrupt them as they go, and it's just hilarious to watch him work. But you get a lot out of it as an actor. You get a lot out of it as a director. And then the other thing that I just haphazardly stumbled into, I ran into my first agent from UTA, Ryan Reber, and Ryan now lives in Austin, and he was like, oh, my friends over at Funny or Die are doing something tonight. You want to go? I was like, yeah, sure. And so we wind up getting into like this VIP thing. It's Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby's doing a comedy routine, and it wasn't the political, nasty Bill Cosby. It was the funny Bill Cosby, so it was awesome.
That is great. That is really cool. So it sounds like it was a pretty neat trip. Anything of interest for some of the smaller creators that are struggling to – get their net neutral?
I think if you go to South by Southwest, the first year you go in mind with the mindset of learning the lay of the land, understanding that there's going to be a lot of things there that you're not going to be able to get into the first year, but you'll figure out how to get into them the second year, and you'll figure out how to get on the party list and how to sign up for the parties ahead of time so that you get into all these different events. And it's really about, it's not so much about the sessions that you go to or the films that you see as much as it is about the networking that you do and the people that you meet and the friends that you hang out with. One of the places that doesn't cost anything to get into is the Driscoll Bar. It's in the Driscoll Hotel in downtown Austin, and that seems to be like the late night place where everybody goes to meet up for a cocktail before they go to bed. And so if you have no money other than you could afford to buy an expensive overpriced drink, that's the place I would recommend going and meeting folks and starting your way into South by Southwest.
Are you one of these people who, you know, there's always someone out there who will say that last year was the last great year of South by Southwest, never worth doing anymore. Are you? Do you still see it as a place that if you're an independent producer or a creator, you should still say, next year we're going to do it, there's still value?
You know, it depends on what kind of producer you are. And if, you know, if you lean towards internet type stuff, definitely go to the interactive thing. If you're more of a film producer, make sure you're there for the film thing. If you're a music producer, you know, wait and go at the end during the music festival. But, you know, as a producer, you've got to spin a lot of plates. You've got to figure out, how am I going to find funding for my next project? What's my next project going to be? Who are the actors going to be that I'm going to put in my next project? That's South by Southwest. All of that is there. You just have to know how to look for it.
And there's a lot of this stuff all in different industries related to content and even into web stuff all happening there. So you just have to really begin to navigate it and network and find where all the people within your network are going to gather, right, Tim? Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. And social media has really made that a lot easier. So if you hook up with friends ahead of time and know what parties to go to and follow where people are on Foursquare, where they've checked in on Facebook, you'll figure things out. It's a lot easier than negotiating some kind of deal to get higher speed video served for your video sharing platform.
That is true. And speaking
that's
of video,
a hell of an endorsement.
Yes, and a hell of a transition to our top five videos traversing that video network this week. Tim is the master of the transition, Michael. So he's we're continually
let's sit
impressed.
Back and watch.
Exactly, it's just amazing watching him go through this thing. So what we do is we go and look at the YouTube charts according to TubeFilter. And you may hear in the background
your alarm just went off.
Yeah, my young daughter is protesting. Thankfully, my wife is downstairs, so she'll attend to whatever that issue is. But we have our top five independent video creators of the week on YouTube. Number five this week, Tim, is Watch Mojo. Have you heard of them?
Is that Canadian channel?
Yes, a Canadian lifestyle thing. They just kind of pump out a bunch of stuff. It seems kind of generic, you know. It doesn't have, but it gets viewed, right? I mean, that seems to be
It's very friendly.
Very friendly to whatever audience they're focusing on. So that's number five. Number four continues to amaze me is our friend the Disney Collector, who is at number four, hundreds of millions of views this week of taking Disney toys out of the box and looking at them. Brilliant. Stampy Longhead is number three. He's the Minecraft guy.
Oh, no, he's the Minecraft guy.
Yeah,
okay,
he's the Minecraft guy. And then number two is Blue Collection, which, like the Disney Collector, is toys with hands and nothing else. Well, nothing bad.
Yeah.
It's all for kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then number one is PewDiePie. Who didn't he say last week he's taking a little break?
But well, he should. he's finished, right? He's made all the money he could possibly make.
Right, and now he'll just collect a royalty check for the rest of his life. So, good for him. So he's taken a little bit of a snoozer there. So in our video stories of the week, though, this one Michael will certainly want to talk about: Netflix versus net neutrality, and another ISP is offering to prioritize Netflix traffic in return for cash. And this is Dutch cable company Ziggo. Recently acquired by competitor UPC for 10 billion euros, is planning to charge video on-demand providers additional fees, according to ZDNet. So this is not in the United States, but is this worrisome, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we see in Europe is different countries take all sorts of different stances in terms of regulation, and we do see places in Europe where all the things that we say we worry about with net neutrality are happening. Where if you want to roll out a neat new technology, you have to sit down in advance with ISPs and negotiate with them.
Really?
If this is what this is, I haven't seen this story, but if there's a Dutch ISP that's saying, yeah, you know what, if you want to distribute video over our network, you're gonna have to pay us extra because, why not? It's our network. We're gonna position ourselves to do that. And if the Dutch government isn't going to step in to stop it, then that's going to bring up the cost of Netflix to people there.
Right, and it's really as an American company to do much about that. Do you think this ICANN thing, where the U.S. government's kind of giving up a portion of its, I guess it's giving up its contract that it has with ICANN, is this something that ICANN can do if there's less government intervention in its organization?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a little bit beyond the scope of ICANN. I mean, ICANN does a lot of important work, but it's mostly organizational work, and not so much how individual networks are run as how all the networks coordinate with each other to make things like the internet work. You know, the U.S. government has been winding down, has been trying to wind down its engagement in ICANN for a long time, because I think that the cost of the harassment they got from people complaining about it wasn't worth a lot of their benefits.
Too many letters to Congress, right?
Yeah, it was sort of like people were like, oh, U.S. government controlling the internet. And they didn't really have that much control over it, and so I think they decided it was finally time to officially sever the end of that relationship.
Very interesting. So, Tim, Warner Brothers, according to TubeFilter, is leading an $18 million funding round for Machinima. That's a pretty big deal.
And this, like, a week or two after Machinima laid off 40 people.
Is that a convenient chain of events there, Tim?
It almost feels like it was part of the deal, right? You guys need to strip down some costs and we'll invest money. And so, boom, they're gone. Here's the money. Have a nice day.
Right. And what are they, is it production they're going to spend this money on? Is it more sales efforts? What does a network spend its time doing?
I think they're going to use the money to pay off an ISP to get faster delivery.
No.
It's a sad reality, right?
They can either invest it in production or paying off an ISP, which is a better use of that money.
Oh, man, that's crazy. The next item is pretty funny. This was TubeFilter reporting on the Zach Galifianakis and Barack Obama interview on Between Two Ferns. That was, speaking of cable access, that's like every cable access set in the country, right? With the fake ferns and the black curtain background.
Wayne's World.
Party time. Excellent. You know, the Wayne's World reality can be true now. You can set up a studio in your basement. I just wish I was as cool as they were. I just review geeky gadgets, but it was actually pretty good. I thought it was entertaining.
It was fun, but there was some backlash. People thought it was unpresidential of the president to do that.
Well, you know, I think
why did he do it?
Right. If he did it because he's trying to reach young people, and young people are watching that, and it certainly wasn't a bad thing for the president because he got a lot of views on it.
And apparently, it drove a lot of traffic to the healthcare.gov website.
Did people actually sign up? Did they? Yeah. Is there an ROI on his time investment?
That will remain to be seen. We'll have to see what happens there. All I know is that I'm covered, and that's But you're right. Will it result in conversions? That's the big question. Another political story this week was what Tim found on McConnelling. And this is a little insider game with Mitch McConnell. So what happens now with these super PACs, and this has been going on for even before the super PACs existed, is a campaign committee cannot coordinate with a third party. So if Michael's super PAC is supporting my run for Congress, he and I cannot communicate. But I can send out things into the ether, like B-roll footage of my candidate doing nothing but, B-roll kind of things that...
Smiling, shaking hands.
Being friendly to people.
Right.
Being friendly.
Being friendly. So what they did is they put up like 2.5 minutes of Mitch McConnell B-roll set to music, which was clearly a transmission to super PACs to use his likeness in their ads. And
if you wanted to use this, here it is.
Yeah, here it is. It's a publicly accessible space. So we're not breaking the law by doing this. We're not coordinating with you. But should you want to make an ad about us, here is very positive footage of our candidate.
No footage of anything eating babies or anything like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, right. It's all just happy-go-lucky smile.
No, but the pendulum does swing both ways.
It sure does, because The Daily Show caught on to this very quickly and is encouraging people to take this footage and make their own videos from it. And we have seen, if you go look for the hashtag McConnelling on Twitter, you will see a lot of the successful work that has come out of this, this sharing of content.
What Jon Stewart did is he found different songs that without editing the footage at all, he would just put music underneath the footage, and it's hilarious. It is absolutely hilarious to see, no one knows what it's like to be the sad man behind blue eyes. And Jon Stewart said that with this particular footage, if you pick a song that has something to do with eyes, it will work perfectly.
And it is hysterical, and it's funny.
People
is
people are making their own, so
they are.
Check out that hashtag.
Somebody did it where they're putting him to like the 80s sitcom introduction, where you always have the character smiling and the name of the actor underneath it. So they have now one where he's like in just about every 80s sitcom you remember as a kid. He's a co-star. So
great. Facts of life,
you name it, he's in there. So pretty good stuff and unintended consequences, but it could be worse for Mitch McConnell than that happening to you. So something that might be good for Maker Studios, Tim Tubefilter again reporting, $500 million acquisition perhaps in the works with Disney. What's that all about?
Well, if you go to Maker and you watch a video on Maker, chances are you'll see an ad for Disney World. So maybe it's cheaper to buy them than
to keep advertising.
Yeah, I don't know.
And Maker owns Blip.tv now, right?
That's correct. Maker bought Blip.
And you think this is like a play for Maker to decide, okay, or for Blip or Disney to kind of get a leg up on Google here with some competing video service? Could that be part of it?
I think that's possible. I mean, the media companies are all investing in this stuff because they've got to figure out a way to shut it down or at least to make money off of it. So they're jumping in to these. You know, I mean, you look at it as the Wild West, and Maker, in terms of the Wild West, is a settler. You know, there were pioneers, and some of those pioneers got acquired by Maker or partnered with Maker, but Maker is a settler. Maker is out there, you know, setting up the ranch and bringing in the cattle and all that, and Disney's more of like a Wells Fargo that's able to convert the gold dust into something more. So you know, that's just the way that it goes. So the
but they kicked the indigenous population off the land, didn't they?
That's the way it works.
That's what happened to me. I got kicked off of there. So,
but Tim, does that mean that Disney just is not going to try and develop their own online?
Oh no, they're definitely developing their own. But I think a lot of it has to do with they don't understand the mechanics of how this works. It's kind of like, you know, imagine the Wild West and how the guys from back east would come out. And they'd be wearing their suits, and they weren't dressed for, you know, working on the railroad. And maybe the food that they ate wasn't the right food, and they got sick. When Asians were hired to work on the railroad, they boiled all their food, and they didn't get sick. They were more prepared for that type of work. And I think that has a lot to do with it. These big companies are used to making movies and TV shows a certain way with a certain budget level. They're not used to micro budget programming. That's the new buzzword. There's micro budget filmmaking and micro budget programming. And it's a big shift. So rather than try to retrain people that are used to having trailers and honey wagons and huge lighting and grip departments, You go with the people that know how to pick up the shovels, picks, and axes themselves.
Like me schlepping away in my basement, right?
There you go. No bulldozers allowed.
Michael, do you want to add something?
Yeah, I was just curious. I mean, when I don't know, this may not be an either or, but if you're someone like Disney and you see a studio like that, is the value more from the people who are operating it and get how to do all those things? Or is it from the content that they're actually rolling out already? Or is it a little bit of both?
I think it's a little bit of both. One, there's definitely an acquisition hire to where you're hiring the talent that knows how to do this.
Right.
And you don't have to retrain people and overpay for it. And then the other thing is they've got the eyeballs. And you're already, you can advertise on it, you can rent it, or you can buy it. And they're looking into buying it. You know, and the other thing is, you know, when you've got cash cows like theme parks and that kind of thing, you got to find a place to hide the money.
Right. Yeah, you got to park it somewhere.
You got to park it somewhere.
You need some expenses to write off. So
I have that problem all the time.
I just can't
find enough places to park my money.
I've heard it's a big problem in Colorado right now with all the people that have opened up the marijuana shops.
Oh, yeah, because they can't use the banks, bank, right?
The banks will not accept their money because the government has said, if you guys are dealing in pot, we're going to shut you down.
Right, it creates a problem. So it's never easy. Although I'm sure
I'm going there to get them to invest in my next web series, Rocky Mountain High.
There's some money out there for you for it, for sure. You could do that, or you can go lobby for a big internet service provider, and you'll have plenty of money there too. Unfortunately,
it's my new series. It's kind of like Video Game High School, but it's all about marijuana. At a high school.
So speaking of trailers, we have some movies on the horizon here, Tim. So our number 5 movie of the week was Tyler Perry's Single Moms Club, $8.5 million this weekend. Nonstop, $10.5 million weekend. They've brought in almost $70 million overall. Need for Speed, $18.3 million opening weekend. Not bad for a start there. 300, Rise of an Empire. It's like 300, but different. $18.8 to $19 million weekend, $77 million overall. And the leader right now, another kid kind of movie, is Peabody and Mr. Sherman. $63.3 million so far and a $21 million weekend. Pretty cool stuff. Popcorn Hour. Have you heard of Popcorn Hour, Tim?
Nope, not at all. But I hear if you go to lon.tv/m43ng, you can learn all about it.
You can learn all about Popcorn Hour. Now, this is what I think is, first of all, I didn't hear about it until they shut it down. This is what makes it harder for us independent content creators to make our arguments. And what this thing was, and I'd love to hear Michael's thought on this, is a Netflix-like viewer that would go out and find BitTorrents for movies that, you know, or just sitting out there on the BitTorrents, and you could click on one of them, and it'll start the torrent download and play the movie. So you didn't have to really, hunt around on the Pirate Bay or something like that. It shut down because obviously they were getting threats of lawsuits, and they didn't want to deal with that. I think they wanted to show that there was a proof of concept here, and it looks like it might continue. There's a torrent site that's thinking about taking on it was an open source project and kind of letting it work. But, you know, Michael, I mean, these kinds of things, I mean, they're making a point that, look, the movie buying public wants more options for buying their movies. However, I don't know if offering movies in this way makes the point very well when we're trying to promote, legitimate uses for this kind of technology, right? I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of elements kind of wrapped up in it, but on its face, this looked like a piece of software that, first of all, I think from a technical standpoint was very interesting, but it did seem to be set up essentially to infringe on copyrights, and so they have their problems there. But I think you're right if you think about it as an example of how you should think about distributing stuff online. I mean, for a long time there was this idea that what you could do, the best way to engage with the internet was to kind of try and sue it out of existence and stop it from happening. And one of the lessons that we've learned over the last decade and a half is someone is going to be out there infringing on your stuff online, and you should take steps to stop that, and those people should be punished. I don't want to
see here's my point on it as a marketing problem. They totally could have stayed in business if they would have charged a fee and changed their name to Find Your Copyright Infringement. So you log in, right? You pay your $20 a month. You log in, and then you type in the title of the thing that you think might, and it goes and finds it for you.
And that could be it. And you'd be ready to go, and you'd have your infringing detector, and maybe a little button. You could pay extra for the DMCA takedown notice button.
Yeah,
right?
you just hit that button, and it sends the notice to the right people.
And you're off and running. The television industry, the people that own the TV networks, minus Comcast, who owns NBC, are concerned, according to the Wall Street Journal, over this merger. Michael, this is in your wheelhouse. Are you working with these folks to try to stop this? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, we're spending a lot of time on this. I think this is something we're very worried about, and we're pushing back very hard. I mean, the good news is that a lot of people are worried about it, and a lot of people are recognizing that this could be a big problem for them. And so
this is a good thing, though. This is a good thing, right? That Comcast is merging with Time Warner. That it allows there to be a nationwide cable provider where people can find out information about products and services, because there will be national ads across that. And so the products and services that you want and know can be directly targeted to you on a national level. Isn't that a good benefit?
Yeah, I mean, we really should just have one cable operator for the entire country. I think that's the best way to go, is to have just no competition at all and have one company making all those decisions. So, I hope that.
And they need to be the ISP, too.
It's so hard to make decisions these days. It'd be so much easier if there was just one place to go and you had no choice at all.
That would be the way to go. And, you know, related to this, Netflix streamed 11% faster in January, according to Bloomberg News, on Comcast's network over last month in January. And, yeah,
how did that happen, Lon?
I should hope so.
Somebody greased those gears there, and it just started working better. And, you know, this is an area where I get concerned, because, you know, consumers get a better experience. So, hey, this is fine, right? This is great. How do we get consumers to realize that, yeah, your trains are running on time, but the dictator that's keeping them in place is not a good thing. Like, how do you combat this? This is right. I mean, this is like how you open the door, give a better consumer experience through a really crappy practice, right?
Well, I mean, it gets even more complicated than that, because it's not even clear, if you look at it, that this is necessarily a crappy practice. All these deals are totally shrouded in secrecy. Nobody outside of them knows. And the real challenge, the kind of the honest challenge of this, is it's very hard from the outside to tell the difference between a legitimate deal and an abusive deal. And because no one except for the people in it know what's going on. You don't know if Netflix took advantage of Comcast or if Comcast took advantage of Netflix.
Right.
And so, because it's going to have such a huge impact on the internet operation as a whole, one of the things that we're talking to the FCC about is what you need to do is at least find out what's going on here. Because, look, it may be that this is a completely legitimate deal. I can tell you a story where it's legit.
Right, it could be a legitimate hearing injury. Right?
We have successfully taken over 100,000 homeless people off the streets over the last year. But what you don't know is that we moved them to Tempe, Arizona. Well, 100 miles outside Tempe, Arizona, we just dumped them there in the desert.
Right. It's all about how you explain the policy decision, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're saying, oh, it's just a legit peering deal. This was in the works forever, right? But we'll never know.
We don't know if it's a legit peering deal or if Comcast said the only way that this thing that competes with our cable service is going to work is if you pay us a giant box of money.
Right. Well, Michael, you're really depressing me.
no, it's good news. No, there's the solution is easy. Yeah. It's have I don't know, let's say a government regulator who has the ability to look in on these things and understands them enough to say, oh, well, okay, if this is a problem, you can come to me and tell me it's a problem and we can actually fix it.
We should probably get somebody that currently works for Comcast to be that person, right?
Or you can just leave and go work for Comcast when you're done.
Right. Sit out that revolving door thing and come on in when that time period's up. So, wow, what a show we've had today. Before we go, I've got a tip of the week, Tim. So here's a little tip of the week. So, you know, I was thinking the other day, I got this domain, lan.tv, which I was just kind of like forwarding to my YouTube channel. And I was really proud of getting that domain, as I've mentioned in ad nauseum on this channel.
You should. You paid enough for it.
Yeah, $200. It was an investment. But there's domains that go for more than that. But I found
it's like a South by Southwest cocktail.
Exactly. I could do that, or I could get a domain. And one of the things that I was thinking about was, you know, you often want to make your own short URLs, but whenever you go to bit.ly to do that, you know, a lot of times somebody's already used that domain name and you can't, or that short URL, you can't use it. So I was like, well, I've got now a domain the same length as bit.ly. Why can't I just do it myself? And I found this great open source project called URLS. So it's called URLS, but URLS.org. And you install this on your web server, and it gives you a URL shortening service that you can control privately. And it is really cool. And if you think about it from the standpoint of how you would be as a content provider, having the ability to send out your brand with every link that you put on Twitter or on Facebook or anywhere else is kind of a neat thing to have in your wheelhouse. And what's nice about it is they've designed it so that when you install it on your web server, it leaves the home directory free. So you still have the ability to just have your base URL go to whatever you want it to go to. But any short URL goes somewhere else.
Do you get analytics?
You get analytics. Yeah, you get all the same analytics you would get with bit.ly. And one thing I did notice is that every time I put a link on Twitter, I get like 22 clicks like immediately. And I don't think they're organic. I think they're bots and stuff doing some analysis. But so it doesn't filter out a lot of stuff, maybe that bit.ly.
Is it always 22?
It's like 22, 23. It's really weird. And it happens
it's
every
just
time.
Him. He just clicks on every link you put out 22 times.
Yep. Yeah, he's stalking me. That's right. I'm flattered.
I'm practicing for playing blackjack, and sometimes I go over.
You got to be careful not to go above that 21. So pretty cool though. It's a neat little tool. It's a great way to kind of, you know, get your brand extended out, and it's been working really great for me. So that is my tip of the week. And wow, I'm tired now having all this policy discussion here. It's like Sunday.
It's exhausting.
I'm sorry, guys.
No, this is good. This is why we like having you on the show. It keeps our brains better, you know? So Michael, where can people find you and the work that you do?
Publicknowledge.org. Publicknowledge.org is the best place, and you can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. It's all public knowledge, public knowledge, public knowledge.
Great. Well, thank you for coming on the show today. Tim, where can people find you?
At One Tim Street.
So you can find Tim there. You can find me at LONSEIDMAN on Twitter or lon.tv for all of your gadget needs. We are back every Sunday, next Sunday, including in that every, next Sunday, 11:30 a.m. Eastern, 8:30 a.m. Pacific time. I record this show live. And if you follow us on Google Plus by going to behindthevideo.com, you will get notified when our show goes on the air so that you can tune in and watch and ask questions.
And subscribe to us on iTunes and leave a comment there. We love comments.
Yeah, please do. We have a lot of people listening and not a lot of people talking to us. And we're like, you know, what are we doing? So how are we doing? Leave a review. Leave a comment. Subscribe to us there. We're on Stitcher. We're on like the Zune thing. We're everywhere. So if you've got a device that has a podcatcher, you can catch us. And that will do it for this edition of Behind the Video. We are a wrap.
Stories for this episode were compiled by producer Jason Perrier. Follow him on Twitter at JASONPERRIER. Behind the Video is a production of Ape Digital Incorporated and the Independent Media Network, LLC. All rights reserved.